Hello and welcome to the Aesthetic Insider Show. I'm your host, Angela O'Maro. I'm so excited I'm here today with Dr. John Vartanian, a facial plastic surgeon who practices in Los Angeles, California. The topic of our show today is rhinoplasty, everything you need to know. Dr. Vartanian, welcome to the Aesthetic Insider. It's such a pleasure to have you here with us today.
Thank you, Angela, for inviting me. It's really a pleasure to be on your podcast. I've actually watched a couple of episodes, and I think it's a real valuable tool to providers and patients alike. And actually, I was watching one of your episodes the other day, and I was like, I learned something.
That's wonderful. Well, you know, before we get going on talking about rhinoplasty, because I know there's just so much information for us to share today, why don't you just tell us a little bit more about yourself, who you are, where you practice, and your background in facial plastic surgery?
Yeah, so my name is John Vartanian. I'm a double board certified facial plastic surgeon here in Los Angeles. And ever since my residency, I've had a burning passion for rhinoplasty, facial plastic surgery in general, but rhinoplasty specifically. And I was really fortunate and very lucky to have a couple of the leading facial plastic surgeon, rhinoplasty surgeons in the country as my mentors and professors. And from there, it's been a journey where I used to, on my vacation time, go and watch these great rhinoplasty masters, many of whom have retired since, to really take as much rhinoplasty knowledge as possible. That on top of reading and obviously taking courses and performing. And now 20 years later, I enjoy sharing that knowledge with younger surgeons and giving lectures and continuing the lifelong journey of learning and perfecting this craft that we call rhinoplasty surgery.
That's fantastic. Well, you know, there's been so many kind of changes and trends and different things over the last 20 years. But when you think about, you know, the nose is the center of the face and really provides harmony if it's positioned correct, if it's structured correctly. And you have been such a pioneer with really fine-tuning and refining the art of rhinoplasty. One of the things I've seen you talk about, or I've heard you talk about, is preservation rhinoplasty. So what does that mean?
Yeah, so the nose looks like a pretty simple structure. It's a little thing in the middle of the nose, but it's a real complex interplay between bones, hard cartilage, soft cartilage, skin, the inside of the nose, the septum that gives sort of partitions in the nose, it creates the structure. And so when you combine that, it's much more like a very complex building where the structures inside have to support both the inhabitants, which is the airflow, and the look on the outside, which is what most individuals seeking rhinoplasty are most concerned with. And so, you know, rhinoplasty is not new. It's been around since 3000 BC, essentially, described in some of the ancient Egyptian papyruses. And throughout history, there's been an evolution in techniques and approaches. And the latest iteration of that is what we call preservation rhinoplasty, which is an approach where we are trying to change the shape of the nose, but change it while preserving those structures that define the bridge and the nasal tip, which are the bones and the cartilages. And there's different categories of preservation rhinoplasty, but I have been adopting that approach more and more over the last 5-6 years, and I love it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it makes sense because, you know, again, you know, my first kind of discussion here on rhinoplasty was the visual side of how it looks to the outside world. Well, then, of course, that patient needs to breathe, needs to sleep, you know, and breathing, of course, is so important just to the human body. So with you, like you said, you're adopting more into moving and trying to preserve everything. Was there ever a trend to not preserving? You know, I know there's different techniques, open versus closed, and so, you know, to those viewers and listeners who aren't quite familiar, can you kind of explain a little bit more?
Yeah, so there's been a move in the last, I would say, 50 years of rhinoplasty surgery towards less destructive methods. So there's techniques that one can use during surgery that look great on the table, meaning right after surgery. It may even look great in the first several months when the nose is swollen. But some of these techniques in some patients can, they don't stand the test of time, mostly because the natural structures, cartilaginous structures, have been violated so that the nose doesn't sort of have a structural ability to support the skin and the breathing ability that a normal nose would have. So in the last 20, 25 years, there's been a steady move towards preserving more structure and cartilage. The big difference between preservation rhinoplasty, and I would say its predecessor, which was structural rhinoplasty, is mostly in the bridge. So in a traditional rhinoplasty, let's say a person has a big hump and we want to reduce it, just like a pyramid, the top of that hump is reduced, and then these walls are brought back together. So we take the roof off, and then we try to reconstruct the rest together back to what would be close to its natural form. In preservation rhinoplasty, the top of the roof is largely intact, and bone from the sides and from the septum is taken away, and the whole thing is brought down. The advantage of that is it's very, very difficult to emulate nature. And so even with the best structural rhinoplasty, in some patients, there's a chance, let's say some thin skin, to have some irregularities. Those are much reduced in dorsal preservation rhinoplasty.
Okay.
And that's one reason I have largely adopted that technique for a lot of our patients. In short, it reduces some of the surgical related, I don't want to say complications, but negative side effects that were much more common with traditional rhinoplasty, and they're less common with preservation rhinoplasty.
Yeah. No, it makes total sense. I mean, it's like building a house, you know, or renovating a house. It's like you take the whole roof off, then that's the whole different build. No, that's wonderful. Now, I would imagine as well, like kind of going back in time a little bit to the nose of the 60s, which was like the ski jump. I would imagine that was completely not a preservation rhinoplasty that was being performed at that time.
Yeah, so it's very interesting. So those first generation or two or three of rhinoplasty surgeries were a lot more dramatic. And, you know, they were great for the time. We stand on the shoulders of giants, and each generation of rhinoplasty surgeons have learned from previous generations. Furthermore, you know, fashions change, trends change. Having said that, though, yes, many of those noses involved removing too much cartilage and tissue or creating very dramatic changes that may look surgical or done. But that retrousse rhinoplasty look is still sometimes asked for by some patients. Yeah. But definitely the techniques we use today are much more sophisticated, elegant, and designed to last the patient's lifetime.
Yeah, that's great to hear. And I think as well, especially now, the trend in cosmetics seems to be a little bit more natural in all aspects. And so, you know,
it's interesting. It was going in that direction, but I think some aspects of social media have brought back a more exaggerated, I would say fake looking look that for some people is an aesthetic goal. And so I sometimes have to sort of advise and counsel a younger or patients who are seeking rhinoplasty surgery that some of the social media noses that are very narrow and exaggerated may not suit them in the long term. Not to mention the fact that some of those noses may also come with significant nasal obstruction issues.
Yeah. I think as well, you know, because I mean, and I won't say this is a trend, but it happens with the revision rhinoplasty. And there's a lot of revision rhinoplasties, but I mean, how many times can you revise a rhinoplasty without compromising, like you said, the underlying structures or the quality of breathing in a patient?
Yeah, the best nose job is the first one you're going to get.
Yeah.
Each time, in general, there are some minor revisions that are easy to do, but in general, each subsequent surgery involves more healing time, more complexity for the surgeon, and less ability to make all the desired changes that we want in the surgery. Again, in general. The best time to get your surgery done well is the first time.
Yeah. Now, I understand that a rhinoplasty is really one of the most complex surgeries in cosmetic surgery. Is that true?
So yeah, rhinoplasty, nasal surgery has been described an operation of millimeters. You know, 1/16 of an inch makes a difference. Yeah. And it's very obvious. It's in the middle of the face. Even the slightest asymmetries become noticeable. So because of that, it really is a very difficult type of plastic surgery, probably the most difficult and demanding of all plastic surgeries, again, in general. And so it really puts the surgeon on their best behavior to really pay attention to all the details. In my case, not only do I really listen to the patients to see what their aesthetic goals are, mm-hmm. but I take 20, 30 pictures with and without a flash, mm-hmm. so I can really analyze the nose with overhead lighting as well as with front lit flash lighting,
yeah,
and really find out what will be the pitfalls of this surgery so we can avoid them.
Yeah.
And that combined with having a big toolbox of different techniques allows the surgeon to have a much higher success rate than otherwise.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's wonderful. Can you explain the difference between a closed rhinoplasty and an open rhinoplasty?
Yeah, so closed rhinoplasty or endonasal rhinoplasty is a nasal surgery where all the cuts or incisions are placed inside the nose. So you look, there's nothing visible on the outside.
Okay.
They're all in the inside. And that's a traditional way of doing rhinoplasty surgery, and I employ that in many of my cases. Open rhinoplasty or external rhinoplasty involves making those inside cuts as well as a small cut at the base of the nose and opening the skin of the nose like the hood of a car, which allows the surgeon direct visualization of the bottom half of the nose and especially the tip and the septum. I personally was trained to do both and I use both techniques. They both have some pros and cons, but it all depends on the case.
What would you say is
which technique we use?
Yeah. What would you say has been the most difficult rhinoplasty case you've ever had?
Well, I've had a lot of very difficult rhinoplasty cases, but in general, if I was advising a person who's getting into rhinoplasty surgery as a surgeon, more as a patient, the most difficult noses to correct are the crooked noses, especially the noses where the crookedness is in the bottom half of the nose. And the reason for that is the bottom half or the bottom two-thirds of the nose are defined by cartilages.
Yeah.
And cartilages, by definition, have a flexibility. So they're a bit more difficult in straightening by just, let's say, breaking them straight or pushing them straight. One has to go in there and really reconstruct those cartilages. And even then, sometimes those cartilages are not completely straight. The analogy is, imagine remodeling a home, but you can't go to a hardware store to buy new material. So we don't have the luxury of going and buying new cartilage, not yet at least. So we have to use sometimes less than ideal cartilage that is contained within the nose to make it perfect. So you can imagine if all the cartilages are crooked or curved or not very strong, it becomes a bit more difficult to accomplish that.
Yeah.
Again, in more extreme cases, we will harvest rib cartilage and use that. But in general, if you ask most experienced rhinoplasty surgeons, what is the most, what gives them sort of headaches or heart pain, chest pain, it's usually the crooked nose.
Okay. Now, you mentioned social media and its influence on rhinoplasty or just facial cosmetic procedures in general. What would you say is like the number one motivation for a patient to come into you now, into your office now for a rhinoplasty?
Well, the number one motivation for patients to come in for a rhinoplasty is they want to look better.
Yeah.
And so much of our self-esteem is tied on how we perceive ourselves and how others perceive ourselves. I mean, it's a duality. So many come in because they are uncomfortable, for example, when they take a picture from the side, the profile view or a quarter view. They'll quite often say, you know, all my pictures are head-on because head-on, I'm okay with my nose. But when I see myself from the side with a smile, I don't like that picture. And so some of it may also be due to, I've had many models and others who want to advance their careers in, let's say, the world of acting or modeling or social media. And so they perceive a smaller nose as being advantageous in those pursuits. And in all honesty, a smaller nose does photograph better than a larger nose. So it does make people more photogenic. And that's another reason, actually, I take a lot of photographs and look at the photographs, because quite often when we look at people in real life, our mind is fascinated by their eyes and their conversation and their other good energy and features. And we don't really analyze the nose as much.
Yeah.
But in a photograph or in a video, the nose tends to become more present. And so making it more harmonious with the face tends to allow that person to express themselves more with their eyes and other features and deliver more of the message and not have the nose sort of distract the viewer or the mind's eye from that person.
Yeah, I had a friend some many years ago, and she had a rhinoplasty, and she used to say, you know, she resembled her father, and she did. But she said, and I don't mind looking like my dad, but I have his nose. And his nose is really big, and it looks great on his face, but it just doesn't look great on my face. And so her motivation was, you know, to look better, you know, better self-esteem, all the things that you say. But like I said, she's like, I love my dad, but I don't want to look like him to this degree. And she ended up getting the nose that she wanted, and it was life-changing for her.
Yeah, one of my mentors, you know him, legendary Dr. Frank Kamer from Beverly Hills. He termed his coin. He used to say, these girls come in with their daddy's nose. And it's true that in general, boys tend to inherit a little bit more from their moms, and the girls tend to inherit a bit more features from their fathers.
Interesting.
So you will see patients whose fathers may have a big nose, and the daughters tend to have more of that feature inherited.
Yeah. That's interesting. I didn't realize that was kind of something that was occurring.
I've noticed that a lot, and you'll see a family come in, and the mom has a normal nose, and the father has a large nose, and the son is somewhere in the middle, and the daughter has gone 80% after the dad, which may seem a bit unfair.
I know. He's no
compared themselves with their moms, and you know, so
wow.
That's where I come in.
That's where you come in, exactly. And you can create harmony to the...
Back to motivation for surgery, I don't want to lighten it that it's all superficial. I have literally a dozen or so successful lawyers who in the past 15, 20 years have gotten their noses done. They all tell me that it was really instrumental in helping them feel more confident, and be more aggressive in both marketing, getting clients, doing better in court, in depositions. And so we live in a world where As strong as we may be on the inside, our physical attributes do influence how people treat us and how we perceive ourselves. So it becomes important in having different avenues and addressing those if it's an issue.
Yeah. No, and I think that's wonderful. And I do think that's kind of where the whole aesthetic industry has kind of developed to this point is, you know, starting from Reconstruction after world wars to now, it really is changing people's lives on many levels. And whether it's something which, you know, it's self-esteem, it sounds as simple as self-esteem, but self-esteem is huge. And it goes such a long way to helping that person be the person they have meant they want to be all along. And so, like you said, whether it's confidence or it's just, you know, you look at yourself and you think, wow, I look great today, you know, and it's changed my life. That's wonderful.
Yeah, and dovetailing with that, creating results that are beautiful and natural, so they don't look surgical, is also something I really, really emphasize. Because I think sometimes patients can get surgery and then feel handicapped or self-conscious because whatever was operated on looks surgical, and now they feel subconscious that, oh, are they staring at my nose because it looks crooked or surgical or fake, whatever the term may be. So that's the next level, which I think we as a community of surgeons are really improving upon previous generations.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I know, you know, we're talking now about rhinoplasty, but as a facial plastic surgeon, you do many other types of facial plastic procedures. Is there anything that's kind of you see with some of your patients that there's a complementary procedure to a rhinoplasty, or some people come in for rhinoplasty, but maybe having something else performed to complement a balance the end result? What would be common things that you would see that would be associated?
Yeah, so rhinoplasty can complement other surgery. So, for example, a slight reduction in the size of the nose and a little bit of a rotation in the tip makes people look younger. So quite often with a facelift, I'll go in there and just do a little tweak to the nose, which creates an even more youthful look to the individual. Mm-hmm. Conversely, with rhinoplasty, you know, classically, if someone has a very soft chin, a smaller chin, putting a small chin implant can bring better balance to the face. You know, the face has got three segments, the upper, middle, and lower. And if they're in harmony, the face looks more balanced and beautiful and natural. So a chin implant is typically described, someone's got a large nose and a small chin. In addition to doing a rhinoplasty, placing a chin implant can bring a better facial balance. What I'm doing a lot, actually, are two procedures. One is under-eye surgery, because a lot of the patients in their 30s are starting to have a little bit of under-eye bags. So what we do for that is either take out the fat that causes the eye bags or do what's called a fat repositioning procedure, or sometimes even some fat injections. And the other is microliposuction of the neck. So as we are improving the nose, we're getting a little improvement in the contour of the neck and the jaw-neck angle.
Interesting.
Those are two, and those are both relatively easy procedures to perform. Mm-hmm. They have almost the same or less recovery than a nose job or rhinoplasty. So it's a nice way of kind of combining healing times and just get it all done.
Yeah. I would imagine too, like when you talk about the pictures and how you take all these pictures, and sometimes a patient is saying, you know, well, I always have my photo head on because you can't see, and versus if the chin augmentation and the liposuction of the neck would give them a better profile along with the rhinoplasty.
Yeah, so sometimes those changes we can show on the computer because, you know, seeing is believing and a picture is worth 1,000 words. That's why I do computer imaging, so that I can be on the same page with the patient as far as our aesthetic goals. Sometimes there are goals that some patients may have that I don't think are realistic, or creating that nose, for example, since we're on a nose topic, may create breathing issues or other issues, in which case I'll tell them I can't do that safely. Alternatively, sometimes patients have ideas, but when you show them a nice morphed picture, they go, I like that, just do it.
Yeah.
And so it really allows me to feel and be on the same page with the patient's expectations. And of course, I take those pictures with me to the operating room. I have it on the wall or on my computer, depending on where I'm going. And this way, I can also individualize each case, because I do a lot of noses. And so each nose is different. And so that has been a fantastic tool, and I use it all the time in every case.
What would you say is the appropriate age, youngest age, for a rhinoplasty?
So that number is it keeps changing with time. In my practice, for the young women, it's 16 and a half, and for the young men, it's 17. Having said that, we can sometimes bring the age down if that individual has significant nasal obstruction or they've had nasal trauma.
Yeah.
The basic concept is this. We want to make sure that that young person is done growing, one, and two, that they're emotionally, psychologically, and mentally mature enough to decide on a change that they're going to live with for the next, for the rest of their lives.
Exactly.
So on the second count, I would say a lot of the young people nowadays are very mature and sophisticated, and they know what they want. So in our practice, it's 16 and a half, 17 in general. I know in large cities like Los Angeles, New York City, there are surgeons who are doing 15-year-olds. Our practice philosophy is to be a bit more conservative. Mm-hmm. And so I started 16 and a half for the young women, 17 and a half for the young boys, young men, boys.
And then on the flip side, what's the oldest rhino patient you've ever done a rhino?
I think age is a number. And so the oldest rhinoplasty I've done was on an 83-4-year-old lady.
Wow.
Who had raised a whole bunch of kids and grandkids. And it was like, you know what? I've always not liked this. And she was healthy. And we did a rhinoplasty on her, and she was thrilled. We did some other procedures too, a facelift. And she was thrilled. So if the patient is healthy and they are of very, very low risk for a surgical procedure, then age becomes a number.
Yeah, yeah. That's
one last thing, back to the youngest age. The youngest person I've operated on where I've done, I would call the rhinoplasty, was a young, really, really sweet teenager who was 13 and a half.
Okay.
But he had fallen off his BMX bike, and his nose literally was in a different zip code.
Oh.
So they were making fun of him in school. He already had a larger nose to begin with. He couldn't breathe. So in that case, the benefits of breathing better, getting better sleep, having a better growth spurt, minimizing ridicule at school, way overwhelmed the theoretical concerns that he still hadn't fully grown.
Yeah.
And I think that he's probably in his 20s now. I mean, you know, I got to call him to come in for long-term photographs.
Yeah.
But yeah, the youngest open formal rhinoplasty I've done, 13 and a half years old.
Yeah. Well, and that makes sense. So, I mean, because of course, if the kid's having trouble breathing and, you know, it's going to affect so many other aspects of his growth, that's an exception to the rule. But I do like how you say that you, in your practice, you like to err on the side of, being conservative in your approach to any procedures, which is only, you know, to the benefit of the patient.
Yeah, I always tell people, we're not treating cancer. We're not treating a broken bone.
Yeah.
It's an elective procedure. We want to do it the right time with the right energy,
mm-hmm.
right motivation, and the right support if the person is, you know, in a relationship or if it's a young person with their parents. Once in a while, I have parents who bring in their usually daughters, and they go, Well, doctor, tell her she needs a nose job. And this young woman says, I'm perfectly content with my nose. My mom is pushing me. And in those cases, I come down pretty hard and say, no, you know, she's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. When the time comes, if it comes, then come back and we can talk about what options we have.
Well, you're a good surgeon, so that's it's a good rule to have. And, you know, I do know in LA and other parts of the country and the world, sometimes moms can be a little pushy with their daughters. So I'm glad
they mean well. I'm assuming they mean well. They feel like, you know, but even well-intentioned, you know, well-intentions have to be matched with the motivation of the person who is a young adult, essentially.
Yeah. So now, and in terms of, you know, we've talked about surgical rhinoplasty and the preservation, the closed versus open, and what all of that means. I know there's other kind of non-surgical approaches. And what are your feelings on non-surgical rhinoplasty techniques?
Yeah, so non-surgical rhinoplasty or liquid rhinoplasty or liquid nose job refers to, it's a really neat approach to the nose. You know, in addition to the bones and the cartilages, there's a skin layer and a fatty layer, and there's space between those hard objects and skin. So one can go with fillers that are generally used for wrinkles or lips, and add a little bit of volume and create favorable change. Usually that changes, you fill this part of the nose and the tip, and you can hide a hump. In fact, you may remember, you know, back in the day, I did something on Entertainment Tonight showing one of the first examples of a non-surgical rhinoplasty. And it works really well. It's in some patients, and it's a neat way of getting some degree of change in the nose. The positive is it's easy to do, and you can hide some types of humps. The negative is sometimes on front view, the nose looks a little bit wider and fatter. So in my experience, it's a gateway procedure. A lot of people have a little bit of trepidation about surgery, and they're intimidated by the concept of surgery. We'll get the non-surgical rhinoplasty, enjoy some of those benefits, and then slowly come to the realization that to really get permanent and meaningful change, you have to go in there and restructure the nose, which is basically surgery. But, you know, non-surgical rhinoplasty could be great for some people who have very minor aesthetic improvement goals. Or even patients who have had previous surgery and they have some irregularities and they're just done with surgery. And a little bit of filler every so often could really address their concerns. So it's a good procedure. It has its place. I do it, in the right person, it's a good procedure.
That's great. Are there any, like, over the course of your career, I'm sure that you've seen many kind of celebrities who patients say, I want to look like this person, I want to nose like this person. Anyone current day that is the desired nose on a fashion or model or celebrity level?
Yeah, so these change with times. You know, it used to be Angelina Jolie, then it was this, then it was that, and Bella Hadid. They change, and maybe in a year or two when someone watches this podcast, it'll be someone else.
Yes.
I always caution people, because a lot of our patients, I encourage patients to bring their inspirational collage of pictures so I can get a feel for what they want. That's important. But you have to keep in mind that many of these pictures are modified on multiple levels. First of all, there's a professional photographer who takes 150 pictures and they pick four or five that are amazing. Yeah. Second, there's a makeup artist. There's lighting. They themselves may have had surgery. And then there's post-production where they may not even be Photoshopped, but they can play around with contrast, lighting, and create honest changes, but are still not reflective of reality. Yeah. And this becomes very noticeable when you look at finished pictures of so-and-so celebrity on a magazine or their Instagram or whatever, and then you see a paparazzi candid shot of them walking out of a gym or a restaurant, and you can see all the imperfections both in their face and their nose. So I always tell patients to, it's okay to get inspiration from that, but that's not reality.
Yeah.
And that's not reality in a way that is not fair to you as a person. And so we're going to try to go that direction, create that feel of the beautiful features of that nose, how the light reflects, the harmony, how it blends with the face. But don't look at that as 100% reality. It's a modified reality image.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So that's what I tell my patients, because, you know, literally every day I have this discussion with patients who will bring their collection of noses that they're in, you know, their inspo pictures, their what inspires them. And I welcome that because I like to get the feel of what they want in their nose. But you have to take that with a grain of, you know, because it's not reality.
You know, and that makes actually makes total sense, because, I mean, being in LA, being in Beverly Hills, of course, we see a lot of celebrities on a daily basis. And many times it's like, oh, I didn't recognize that person.
Oh, my God. I'm not going to out anyone because it's against HIPAA rules. But not only do I have a number of patients who are well-known, but I've also met some of these people in other settings. And there's times where I don't recognize them. And for a simple fact that, for example, person A, you associate with flawless skin, and then you see with a baseball cap and 3-4 pimples. And I'm like, the eyes are hers,
yeah.
But it's like a double take. So we all have to be careful with public figures. And they have a very tough job because they're human beings. They're real people. Mm-hmm. They have good days and bad days. And yet they're always on the spotlight. They always have to be on.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have to be on. We can have a bad day and it's normal. But they always have to be on. So, but we, you know, especially for young people, they have to be very cautious that these individuals have a public persona image, and they have to preserve that. And sometimes that image is not the reality. So we got to be careful in what we aspire to compare ourselves with.
How would a patient get onto another level of rhinoplasty now? What about recovery time, or how a patient would prepare for a procedure? What again, you've been doing this for quite some time now, so I'm sure you've got some tips and secrets of things that you do to make that patient journey as flawless.
Yeah. So rhinoplasty recoveries are really very surgeon dependent. It's a little bit luck dependent too. Some people recover faster than others. But there's a number of things that I've done in our practice to really reduce recovery times.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we don't put any plastic splints inside the nose, no packing. You know, the nose looks, again, very simple, but if you look at it under magnification, there's multiple layers. So one of the principles, for example, of preservation rhinoplasty is to go as deep as possible when elevating those layers so we can avoid disrupting blood vessels, nerves, lymphatics, and the very thin muscular layers of the skin. And so by doing these, we can get to the bones and the cartilages and create the change that we want to create, but create less trauma, swelling, bruising, and hopefully pain. So in our practice, I give a prescription for pain meds to all our patients. My estimation is 95 to 98% don't take their pain meds. If they take anything, it's just regular Tylenol for maybe a night or two. So again, everyone is different, but a great, great majority of our patients have a very easy recovery. And again, that's partially the patient, but it's mostly the surgical techniques used to minimize, you know, collateral damage or, you know, trauma to the surrounding tissues, so we can get the job done with the minimal amount of recovery, hopefully no need for pain meds, and again, to make the experience as stress-free as possible. So most of our patients take about a week and a half off work,
mm-hmm.
and that's mostly for social purposes. So if someone works from home or they have a a job that is not a front office job, they could probably get back into an intellectual work on day two or three from home with the cast on. But for most of our patients who want to go to work and not be stared at, we recommend taking about 8-9 days off.
Okay.
We're full recovery socially, that is.
And then beyond that, because I know every patient is different, and it depends on the surgeon as well and the level of penetration, you know, preservation, rhinoplasty, whatever technique you're using. How long do you think before the patient can say, oh, you know, I really love this result? I mean,
yeah. So the full recovery has really three stages. One is the swelling from the trauma of the surgery. Even the most gentle surgeon is going to cause some trauma because we're doing surgery. So there's a period of time when that swelling, or as we call it in medicine, edema, has to settle down. So that's the first stage. Second stage is for the skin to shrink to show off that newer understructure. So let's say in most of our cases, we're making the nose a little bit smaller. And so we remove bone and cartilage and create some nice change. And the skin does reflect that initially, but the skin has to shrink also to show off that smaller nose. And then the third stage is for the lymphatics and the other normal vasculature, the blood vessels and lymphatics, to be fully reestablished. So that the whole process could be as short as 4 to 6 months or as long as 2-3 years, depending on the type of case being done. So that's why we typically say it takes a year, 9 months at least, for the nose to really settle in and for us to start analyzing the real result. Now, again, for some people, depending on what's done, their skin thickness, their own healing abilities, that could be 6 months. For others, it could be 2-3 years. Mm. So that sometimes could be a source of frustration for some patients, because they may say, my friend had surgery by you and she was going out on week three showing off her new nose. Here I am on month three and my nose is still kind of pudgy or swollen. So that's sort of like two people going to the gym and getting a slightly different response from their training regime. It's just part of the deal. And that's why I tell people, as much as it's important to have the motivation to get the surgery, you have to have the emotional reserve so that if your nose, for example, or any surgery, the healing time is a little extended, or you have a minor complication, which is normal, it happens, or your swelling time is extended, you're able to absorb that time and not have it really be a life-changing event that can make you depressed or not interested in normal activities. And that can happen sometimes, because sometimes patients people think that getting a surgery is like buying an iPhone or a product. I can afford it. I found the right provider. I'm going to have it and it's done. Well, that is mostly true. But there is an in-between period where the patient has to go through a process of healing, both physical and sometimes emotional, before that final result arrives. And then sometimes that final result is in the hands of nature and biology and healing. And even the most advanced surgeon can't really do much to move that along.
Yeah.
So that's one of the... We as surgeons are somewhat guilty of this. We post these beautiful before and afters, but sometimes the journey is not highlighted. The journey sometimes is, there's a period of time where things may not be A-okay for the patient because they're healing. So anyone having any kind of surgery has to keep that in mind, that one may have an extended healing period. Build that in as far as important events like interviews, shooting a movie, weddings, or vacations, you know.
Yeah, that's a great point. So what would you say to somebody who does have a wedding or a film, you know, a movie they're filming, or they've got something important that they're going to be on camera or, you know, on video?
Yeah. So it depends on the the degree of change being accomplished. So I've actually done rhinoplasty surgeries on people who were in a beauty pageant or went to shoot movies literally 6 weeks later. But the changes we made were very mild and subtle, so that bit of swelling wasn't a big deal. In general, for weddings and really important events, I tell people to give at least 4 to 6 months.
Okay.
For rhinoplasty surgery. And that probably applies to any super important event where those pictures are going to be with you forever.
Yes.
Because one wants the nose to settle down, and you never know if someone's healing is a bit slower and more delayed.
Yeah.
So you want to have a margin of safety.
Now, you mentioned earlier how kind of the techniques have changed and some of the things that we're doing, you know, you were doing to the nose 20 years ago, you don't do today. But I understand there's like new tools and there's new methods and ways of looking at the nose, but you have a newer toolkit than you had 20 years ago. So what is in that toolkit?
Yeah, so for over 100 years, rhinoplasty surgery, modern rhinoplasty surgery started in the early 1900s, late 1800s, with most famous was Jacques Joseph from Berlin, who was actually an orthopedic surgeon, and he used these chisels and tools for breaking bones for breaking the nasal bones. And largely, those tools have remained the same. Of course, there's been a lot of refinements, they're smaller, there's a lot of refinements that have happened, but it's the same concept. Now, that concept has served many surgeons well, and I still use those tools. But in our toolbox, we have a new device which uses ultrasound to basically create precise cuts in the bone without harming the soft tissue. So ultrasound at a certain frequency or vibration level can cut through hard mineralized compounds like bone and can largely leave the skin and the soft tissues unharmed. And so there's different names for it, piezoelectric, ultrasound, sonopet, different manufacturers have different names, but essentially these are ultrasound devices that we can use to make very controlled, fine cuts in the bones, so then we can move the bones in a precise way without using hammer and chisel. Now, there are some cases where you still have to use that, but again, it's another tool in our toolbox. And obviously, the more tools we have in a toolbox, the more we can customize our surgeries to each patient to minimize downtime and maximize results.
Well, that's amazing. You know, I didn't expect when I, you know, kind of invited you to be a guest on the show and we were going to talk about rhinoplasty that you've given us such a great historical and educational journey into everything associated with rhinoplasty and the importance of really kind of doing your homework before going on this journey as a patient. Is there anything that we haven't yet touched on or any questions I haven't asked that you'd like to kind of explore or discuss a little bit more for our audience?
You know, I could talk about rhinoplasty for days until, you know, someone gets a headache. And what I love doing, actually, one of my favorite things is to sit with other rhinoplasty surgeons and some of my mentors and really talk about what a amazing operation it is, but it's an operation that you'll never master because it's very complex. You just get better and better. There's always going to be a nose that one encounters where the anatomy is different. So it's a fascinating field. I love teaching, learning, performing rhinoplasty. I would say the last thing I would say, especially for patients who may be watching this or people prospective rhinoplasty candidates, someone wants to get a rhinoplasty surgery, is talk to many surgeons because it's a learning experience. And the more you hear different surgeons recommending a similar treatment solution, the more you'll understand what is right for you. Unfortunately, with social media, advertisement, this and that, there can be a lot of hype associated with any product, any service. And with rhinoplasty, you don't want hype. You want reality, and you want someone who cares about you, like they're a member of your family, of their family, and does techniques that are both innovative and yet also stand the test of time. So that's what I would recommend. Talk to multiple surgeons and get a feel for what is right for you and who is the right surgeon for your particular nose and your motivation, aesthetic and functional.
Well, like you said earlier, the first rhinoplasty is generally the best. And so really what you're saying is, you know, talk to multiple doctors, maybe talk to patients as well, but you want to make sure that you get it right the first time as much as possible.
Absolutely, yeah. And so one way to do that is to do your homework, and the homework is to look at their before and afters. That's important. And go meet with the doctor, either, you know, virtual or in person, and get a feel for their vibe and what their treatment plan is. And then learn the anatomy and ask questions. You know, the more you know, the more you can understand the language of rhinoplasty. And that's, I think most surgeons would welcome that interest, that person cares about this beautiful anatomy and wants to learn about it so they can be more involved in their own rhinoplasty journey.
John, well, thank you so much for being on the Aesthetic Insider. It's been a great show, and I really appreciate just this expert information that you are taking the time to share with our viewers.
Well, thanks for inviting me. And again, I love talking all aspects of facial plastic surgery and especially rhinoplasty surgery. It's a real pleasure to be on your podcast, and thank you for inviting me, and look forward to seeing you in meetings and other great things you're doing.
And great. Thank you. Thank you. And for those of you still with us, please remember to watch next Wednesday for another exciting episode of The Aesthetic Insider.